Very excited. Let's get into things for this morning. We're going to be in Mark. I have to admit, guys, this, don't let it scare you. I'm going to say this and you're going to be like, oh my land, are we ever going to get out of here today? For some reason, I thought it'd be a great idea to really bite off more than I could chew this morning. We're going to be kind of looking of about Mark 1:40 to Mark chapter 3, verse 6. And you're going, what in the world? Just bear with me. I promise it'll happen. Okay. We're going to zoom through some things. We're going to spend some more time on some other things. But we are talking about, we started last week, a series that we are calling Disciple. It's a study through the book of Mark. And so we are right at the beginning of it. We just started last week with the first 11 verses and continuing on today. Before we get there, I want to just, again, I tell you all the time, I'm a movie buff. I love movies. I want to just bring you into a movie this morning. And I want you to think about who could possibly forget the sweetness and the innocence of Cindy Lou Who. The character created by Dr. Seuss way back when in the book How the Grinch Stole Christmas. And as the story goes, I had the story pulled up. I figure it's been a while since I've read a kid's story to us, so we're going to read a little bit of How the Grinch Stole Christmas this morning. The story goes this way. Every Who down in Whoville liked Christmas a lot, but the Grinch who lived just north of Whoville did not. The Grinch hated Christmas the whole Christmas season. Now, please don't ask why. No one quite knows the reason. It could be his head wasn't screwed on just right. It could be, perhaps, that his shoes were too tight. But I think that the most likely reason of all, and you know the line, don't you, may have been that his heart was two sizes too small. Continuing on a story, I don't have time to read the whole thing, but we know the Grinch knows that he must do whatever he can to stop Christmas at all costs. So he devises this plan, doesn't he? It's just as devious and just as sinister as his wicked little smile. We continue on in the story, and we get an idea of what this this idea that he has is. Let me continue on here. Come on. Then he got an idea, an awful idea. The Grinch got a wonderful, awful idea. All I need is a reindeer. Oh, he goes, I know just what to do. The Grinch laughed in his throat, and he made a quick Santa Claus hat and a coat. And he chuckled and clucked, what a great Grinchy trick. With this coat and this hat, I look just like Saint Nick. All I need is a reindeer. The Grinch looked around, but since reindeer are scarce, there were none to be found. Did that stop the old Grinch? No, the Grinch simply said, if I can't find a reindeer, I'll make one instead. And so he called his dog Max, then he took some red thread, and he tied a big horn on the top of his head. Then he loaded some bags and some old empty sacks on a ramshackle sleigh, and he hitched up old Max. Then the Grinch said, giddy up! And the sleigh started down toward the homes where the Whos lay a snooze in their town. And after ransacking the place and stealing the stockings and presents, the whimsical doctor tells us in the next part of the story as he gets into one of the Whos' houses, he slithered and he slunk with a smile most unpleasant around the whole room, and he took every present. Pop guns and bicycles, roller skates, drums, checkerboards, tricycles, popcorn and plums. And he stuffed them in bags. Then the Grinch very nimbly, I love this line, stuffed all of the bags one by one up the chimbley. Then he slunk to the icebox and he took the Who's feast. He took the Who pudding. He even took the roast beast. He cleaned out that icebox as quick as a flash. Why, that Grinch even took their last can of Who hash. And then he stuffed all the food up the chimney with glee. And now, grinned the Grinch, I'll stuff up the tree. And the Grinch grabbed the tree and he started to shove when he heard a small sound like the coo of a dove. He turned around fast and he saw a small Who, little Cindy Lou Who was not more than two. The Grinch had been caught by this tiny Who daughter who'd got out of bed for a cup of cold water. She stared at the Grinch and said, Santa Claus, why? Why are you taking our Christmas tree? Why? And he told a little lie, didn't he? You know that old Grinch was so smart and so slick. He thought up a lie. He thought it up quick. Why, my sweet little tot, the fake Santa Claus lied. There's a light on this tree that won't light on one side. And so I'm taking it home to my workshop, my dear. I'll fix it up there. I'll bring it back here. And he fib fooled the child. Then he patted her head and he got her a drink and he sent her to bed. And when Cindy Lou Who went up to her with her cup, he went to the chimney and stuffed the tree up. Then that was the last thing he took was the log for their fire. And then he went up the chimney himself, an old liar. On their walls he left nothing but hooks and some wire. And the one speck of food he left in the house was a crumb that was even too small for a mouse. Now there's a line in the, or a scene in the movie, The Grinch Stole Christmas, where they change things around a little bit. And instead of the Grinch coming to Cindy's house, Cindy goes up to the Grinch's lair. And in this sweet little moment, as he is going crazy and in all his grinchy and grumpiness, she simply looks at him in her sweetness and says, "Mr. Grinch, I would like to invite you to Christmas in Whoville." And she actually says, "What? I would like to make you the master, what? Cheermeister." Oh, it sets the Grinch off, and he ends up in town, and we know how the rest of the story goes, that his heart, it says, ends up growing. And it says that even he, at the end of everything, carves that roast beast that he stole from little Cindy Lou Who. That whole story, I think, in so many ways, especially the smallness of the size of the Grinch's heart, speaks and sets up very well where we're going for this morning. In Mark chapter 1, starting at verse 21, it says this: "Jesus and his companions went to the town of Capernaum. When the Sabbath day came, he went into the synagogue and he began to teach. The people were amazed at his teaching, for he taught with real authority, quite unlike the teachers of religious law. And suddenly a man in the synagogue..." Now just get this for a minute. Just imagine that I'm sitting here preaching and all of a sudden somebody starts shrieking and starts yelling out. Please don't anybody do that, by the way. That's just going to be weird. "A man in the synagogue was possessed by an evil spirit, and he began shouting, 'Why are you interfering with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One sent from God.' Jesus cut him short. 'Be quiet. Come out of the man,' he ordered. And at that, the evil spirit screamed, threw the man into a convulsion, and then came out of him. Amazement gripped the audience." Do you think so? "And they began to discuss what had happened. 'What sort of new teaching is this?' they asked excitedly. 'It has such authority. Even evil spirits obey his orders.' The news about Jesus spread quickly throughout the entire region of Galilee." Last week, like I said, we began our study on the book of Mark by introducing both Jesus and John the Baptist and their complementary ministries, how they work together in and around Judea and in Jerusalem. And this morning we move north out of Jerusalem and we move to the region in Israel that was known as Galilee. Specifically today we're going to be spending our time, all the stories will center in the town of Capernaum. And as we learned last week, Mark's goal in his entire gospel and his conviction is introducing Jesus and his ministry to herald the beginning of something new. Something is happening here that has never happened before. And the series of events, guys, that we're going to be looking at this morning could not be more overt, and they're pointing to something that is new and unique and different. It begins right off the bat in verse 22 when we're told that the people in this synagogue in Capernaum are amazed at Jesus' teaching. Now, we would look at that and we'd say, that's great. Yeah, I would be amazed at Jesus' teaching as well. But the word that's used here for the word amazed is a really, really interesting one. Literally, the word for amazed here means to strike with panic or shock. Really, what it's trying to give us a sense of is that the people in this synagogue on this morning when Jesus is teaching are out of their minds. Their minds are blown at Jesus' words, the authority with which he taught. One commentator, William Barclay, he renders the word amazed this. He says that it actually, the people were thunderstruck. Actually, the words of Jesus are so striking, they're so threatening, they're so mind-rattling that it causes a demon in the middle of Jesus' preaching to reveal himself. Now think about that one for a minute. In a house of worship, in a place of worship, now we understand this about demon possession from Scripture, that demon possession, they only oppress believers. They don't possess believers. And so this man in a house of worship must have been a non-believer, and this demon reveals himself. The sound, simply at Jesus' sound and his words and the authority that he has in preaching God's word, this demon gets very defensive. It has him all shook up. And ironically, I want you to notice this as we move through the Gospel of Mark, and especially right here at this moment. In the first half of Mark's Gospel, the only people, the only beings that are sure of Jesus' true identity and who he was, guess who they were? Demons. That's just comical to me. Nobody else gets who Jesus is, but demons understand very, very clearly who Jesus is. The Jewish leaders reject Jesus. The crowds are curious, but they're noncommittal towards Jesus. Even the disciples, the 12 guys that he chooses all throughout the Gospels, exhibit some sort of hard-heartedness, some doubt, some questioning. But the demons know for sure who Jesus is. But as Jesus often does throughout the book of Mark, he commands this demon to be silent. Actually, it's a bit more of a forceful word. It's something along the lines of, muzzle it, buddy. Or we would put it this way in our modern terms, shut your trap, is what he says to this demon. Throughout his ministry, Jesus repeatedly forbid demons from testifying about him. And they were right in who he was. The identification was accurate. But here's the thing, Jesus did not need his publicity coming from demons. Did not need his publicity coming from the power of Satan. So whenever the demons spoke up and identified Jesus for who he was, and if you notice here, he catches Jesus on both levels. He says, I know who you are, Jesus of Nazareth. I identify you in your humanity, but you are also the Son of God, the Holy One of God. I recognize you in your godness too. See, here's what happened and what's true of things in Jesus' day is that when one's name was said by an adversary, it was seen as an act of submission. You guys remember the story way back in Genesis when Jacob is wrestling with an angel of the Lord, don't you? And they go back and forth all night, and Jacob finally asks the angel, what is your name? And what does the angel say? I ain't gonna tell you. It's that whole idea there. I'm not gonna give you submission over me. In fact, in Jesus' day, there was a very well-known idea that the exact knowledge of the other's name brought mastery or control over them. And that's why this demon revealed Jesus. He outed him. It was one last attempt of this demon to get rid of Jesus. The demon unveils Jesus' identity, thinking that if I just out him, I'll just defeat him. Guys, did it work at all? Not in the slightest. It doesn't work whatsoever with Jesus. And this opening story brings out a really interesting question that's super important throughout the whole book of Mark. Verse 27 says that in amazement, there's that word again, in awe, in shock, in being thunderstruck, they were gripped. The audience was gripped, and they asked, what sort of new teaching is this? Guys, what they are saying in this moment right here, I am convinced, is one of the biggest questions that you can ask in life. What are they really asking in this moment? Who is Jesus? Who is this guy? And guys, Jesus doesn't leave them waiting and wondering for very long. In typical Mark fashion, we talked last week that the whole book of Mark is just very fast-paced. Boom, boom, boom. So the word immediately is used over 40 times throughout the whole book of Mark. And in typical fashion, Mark whisks us away to the next scene. It's a very important one in continuing to reveal Jesus' identity. Continue with me, starting at verse 29 through verse 34. After Jesus left the synagogue with James and John, they went to Simon and Andrew's home. Now Simon's mother-in-law was sick in bed with a high fever. They told Jesus about her right away, immediately. There's that word. So he went to her bedside, took her by the hand, and helped her sit up. Then the fever left her, and she prepared a meal for them. I was talking about this in Bible study this morning. Whenever you have a fever for a couple days or 3 days or for a week, do you feel all that great after you get done with the fever and it breaks? No, you're wiped. You don't want to do anything. It says everything about Jesus' authority to instantly heal and restore people. says he simply touches her, she sits up, and she goes and serves a meal. Boom, just like that, healed and restored. It says that evening after sunset, many sick and demon-possessed people were brought to Jesus. The whole town gathered at the door to watch. Now, I don't really believe it was probably the whole town, a bit of a hyperbole, but there's a lot of people showing up at the door. And so Jesus, what's it say there? He's like, guys, I'm tired. I don't have time to do this. Could you just come back tomorrow? Does Jesus say that? No, it doesn't say that. Jesus healed many people who were sick with various diseases, and he cast out many demons. But because the demons knew who he was, he did not allow them to speak. There it is again. The idea here again in the language is that people just kept coming and coming and coming. And Jesus didn't ever say, hey guys, I'm really hungry. Could you go like maybe order a pizza or something? Because I'm stuck here. No. He didn't even think about anything like that. He had a job to do, and that was to heal and to show his compassion toward these people. And here's what's really kind of insane to me. Jesus could have healed Peter's mother-in-law any way he pleased. I mean, guys, the Gospels are chock full of miracles where he healed someone in a variety of ways. And each method that he chose to use in healing someone communicated what he needed to address in that person's life. And in this case with Peter's mother-in-law, he simply, what does he do? It says he just reaches out and he touches her, takes her by the hand. And I think what this shows here and what this whole section is going to show is that Jesus just has a natural, instinctive, sympathetic love. He has what we would call compassion. Now, I was sharing this morning in Bible study. I was saying, hey, guys, if you were to rate yourself on like a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being like horribly non-compassionate and 10 being just so wonderful, lovely, and fuzzy that you're like a little teddy bear, where would you rate on that scale of compassion? I said, I have no doubt in my mind I would answer probably more than often than not about a 3. I'm just normally not a very compassionate person. But with Jesus, he is just intrinsically, at heart level, a compassionate person. To touch people in healing and in love is just an instinct of Jesus. It's just who he is. There's a sense that in Jesus, in the time that Jesus was around in all of Galilee and extended even down to Jerusalem and Judea, that really all sickness and all hurt and all pain just sort of went out of the window for a while. And it's just because Jesus had such a love and a care for people. Didn't matter who they were, where they came from, what they were struggling with, Jesus says, I want to meet your need, but I want to go deeper than that. And we'll talk about that in just a bit. Guys, this is not just first century Mark's writing about this. Jesus wants to do that with each of our souls. He wants to reach in, and he wants to heal, and he wants to restore. He wants to do that for those who know him, and he wants to do that especially for those who don't know him. Guys, I think we have to admit this. I think we have to know this every single day, that every single one of us needs a touch of grace in our lives. We need the compassion of Jesus in our lives. And again, in spite of the steady stream of people who come to Jesus for any number of reasons, Jesus, with infinite compassion, lays his hands, continues to touch people, and he heals every one of them. This is Jesus. This is the Jesus we see in the Gospels over and over again. He consistently sympathizes with the pain and the sickness of those whom he healed. He knew full well the agony that these people were in. The Gospels repeatedly tell of Jesus' compassion for those who experienced his healing touch. But what is exceptionally enlightening is that by and large, Jesus, catch this, we understand this, right? Jesus, by and large, was just being used by mankind. Wherever Jesus went, people only wanted him for what he could do for them. And even in spite of that, Jesus knew this full well. I mean, you hear this over and over in the Gospels. It's like Jesus knows people's hearts. Jesus knows that they didn't really want him. They just wanted his good stuff. Even in spite of that, Jesus genuinely cares for people. He cares about their problems. He cares about people who are being so insincere towards him. And I have to ask that in our own lives, guys. Are there ever any moments in our life where we are just using Jesus for what he can give to us? And you think about that long enough and you go, yeah, I bet there was a moment when that happened. But on the flip side, think about the fact that even in that, Jesus has so much care and love and grace and mercy for you. Which brings us to the next stop on a day in the life of Jesus. In one of the most shocking and unexpected encounters in the gospel, Jesus continues to display his compassion. Mark chapter 1, verse 40. A man with leprosy came and knelt in front of Jesus, begging to be healed. And these are very interesting words, by the way. If you are willing. See, there is every ounce of faith in this guy. He knows that Jesus can heal him, but he's not sure if he will heal him. If you are willing, you can heal me and make me clean, he said. And then here's this word, moved with, what is it? Compassion. Jesus reached out, and what does he do? He did it again. Touched him. I am willing, he said, be healed. Instantly, the leprosy disappeared and the man was healed. And then Jesus sent him on his way with a stern warning. Don't tell anyone about this. Instead, go to the priest and let him examine you. Take along the offering required in the law of Moses for those who have been healed of leprosy. This will be a public testimony that you have been cleansed. But we know the story, don't we, right? The man went and spread the word, proclaiming to everyone what had happened. And we'd be like, that's a good thing, right? I mean, he went and he spread the good news, right? But here's the only problem. Jesus said, don't. And he disobeyed and did it anyways. It's a problem for a number of reasons. It causes kind of a hype and a hysteria and kind of this, we're going to see it here in just a minute. Jesus can't go anywhere without having people come to him. And guess what? Jesus' main role and his main job in coming to the earth was not to do a bunch of miracles. Those were only signs for what he was really there to do, and that was to preach and to teach the people. Man goes and spreads the word. As a result, large crowds soon surrounded Jesus, and he couldn't publicly enter a town anywhere. He had to stay out in secluded places, but people from everywhere kept coming to him. Now, guys, to fully understand this, and I really want to just slow down for a minute on this particular story because it's a major one. To fully understand the scenario of Jesus with the leper, we have to get a handle on leprosy and leper colonies in Jesus' day. The early Jewish historian Josephus said that a leper, catch this, is in no way different from a corpse. I mean, what was he saying? A leper back in Jesus' day was just a dead man walking. Rabbis held that it was impossible to heal a leper, and it was just as impossible to do that as it was to raise a man from the dead. According to the Talmud, which was an ancient Jewish book of law, code, and theology, the closest that a leper could come to someone without the disease was 6 feet. Sound familiar to our day, boys and girls? On a windy day, the distance between the leper and someone who was not infected with it went up to 150 feet. But guys, here is what makes, I mean, I could tell you all about leprosy and the physical effects of leprosy, and they're not pretty, by the way. The worst part of leprosy, what made it so bad and so painful, was not necessarily the physical pain. In fact, your body starts to go numb with leprosy. You don't feel anything physically. Guys, the social isolation of leprosy is what really hurt about leprosy. You couldn't see family. You couldn't see friends. Guess who you hung out with for the rest of your life? A bunch of other lepers. And let me tell you this, on a very graphic level, leprosy smells horribly. Flesh rotting off of people. It's not pretty and lovely. Guys, from a first century perspective, Jesus has every right in this moment with this leper to be outraged by his actions. The man disregarded social norms. He disregarded safety. He disregarded the law. But what does Jesus do? I mean, he could have railed on this guy. And he doesn't get angry, does he? Instead, he is moved with compassion. When it says that Jesus is filled with compassion, it is an instinctive reaction. He felt it in his stomach. It went beyond pity. It went beyond sympathy. It moved to the gut. Have you ever had a moment in life where you felt so deeply for somebody or something that you just felt it right there? It's a picture of the Father and the Son's heart. He has compassion for each need, heart for heart, gut to gut. I've told you this before. This is one of my favorite Greek words of all, for the Greek word compassion. It is splanknizomai. And it literally means to be moved in the inward parts. That's what splanknizomai means. Jesus in this moment is moved in the inward parts. But he does more than just understand the hurt or the pain or the brokenness of every one of us. Guys, we understand this side of the cross that he felt the full weight of our brokenness and our sin and our pain and our needs all the way to and on the cross, didn't he? He is motivated in every moment of his ministry by genuine compassion. He stretched out and he touched this man. Guys, no one had probably physically touched this man in who knows how long. And in a moment of total vulnerability and kindness, Jesus touches and heals him. But I want you to see something deeper in this story. More than just being an act of kindness and an act of compassion, God wanted to make a very, very clear point in this moment. His kingdom is defined by true compassion. The infinite care and kindness that he demonstrated, he was willing to come near to those that no one else was willing to even look at, let alone come near. And with the powerful words, "I am willing, be cleansed," he touched the man and he healed this man. And what is really super striking to me, guys, is that you see what happens in the story, don't you? A leper who is on the outskirts of society, who no one will even look at, associate with, touch, has now become an insider. And do you see what's happened with Jesus in the story? What does it say? It says he could become so popular and so many people want Jesus that he can't even come into the towns anymore. He has to go out to the isolated places. You see what's happened in the story, don't you? They've traded places. Guys, Jesus has done that for every one of us. Jesus says you don't have to live out on the outside anymore. You don't have to feel this hurt. You don't have to feel this pain. You don't have to feel this isolation. I take it. I trade places with you. I make you as an outsider to become an insider. Guys, that is the essence and the reality of the gospel. Jesus traded places with sinners in order to deliver them from their sin. On the cross, outside the city, Jesus was treated as an outcast so that you and I, who were outcasts, might be brought into the inside, to the love and to the redemption of God. Warren Wiersbe says it this way, commenting on Jesus' healing of the leper. Jesus told this man to keep quiet, and this man told everybody. Now listen to this. Jesus commands us to tell everybody, and what do? Quiet. Guys, the leper's sickness is largely symbolic at this moment. It's made to have us realize that apart from the work of Christ, we would be decaying forms of walking death. The truth is, guys, all of us are spiritual lepers in some way. The problem, though, is that some of us just don't know it. We just don't understand that we're spiritual lepers. And unlike this physical leper who is well aware of his sad state, we just continue to move on in life like nothing's wrong. Guys, Jesus didn't spend his life and his time and his ministry in a monastery. He didn't stay secluded and isolated and in a bubble from everywhere, from everyone else. He was where people were. He was where there was pain and suffering. It's almost like he sought it out because he genuinely and he deeply cared for people. Because these stories of healing leave the single impression that Jesus came to make people whole. He came to make outsiders insiders through compassion and forgiveness and mercy and grace. I don't know about you, but I believe this to be true, that all of us at some point of our lives have felt like or have been outsiders. That could not have been more true for the man that we're going to read about next. Mark chapter 2, verse 13. Then Jesus went out to the lake shore again, and he taught the crowds that were coming to him. And as he walked along, he saw Levi, son of Alphaeus, sitting at his tax collector's booth. It wasn't really a booth, it really wasn't a house, it really wasn't a stand, it was like a little shack. Follow me and be my disciple, Jesus said to him. So Levi got up and he followed him. Later, Levi invited Jesus and his disciples to his home as dinner guests, along with many other tax collectors and other disreputable sinners. Now, listen, watch this. Don't skip over a parenthesis. There were many people of this kind among Jesus' followers. You see who Jesus is hanging around with, don't you? You see who Jesus is trying to change, don't you? Not goody two-shoes, not religious elite, sinners. Jesus loved to roll with those people. But when the teachers of religious law, who were Pharisees, saw him eating with tax collectors and other sinners, they asked his disciples, why does he eat with such? In my translation, it says, scum. When Jesus heard this, he told them, healthy people don't need a doctor. Sick people do. I have come to call not those who think they are righteous, but those who know they are sinners. Guys, much like lepers, tax collectors were considered unclean and they were social outcasts, unfit for anything to do with God. In fact, some religious writings in the Jewish religion register very scathing judgments of tax collectors. In fact, they lump them together with thieves and murderers. That's not good company, boys and girls. In fact, a Jew who collected taxes was expelled from the synagogue and a cause of disgrace to his family, the two things that meant the most back in Jewish society. Some jobs, guys, require very thick skin. Anybody feel like they have a job? It's like, yep, I need some thick skin every single day of my life. Imagine being a parking meter attendant in a city. Is that one of the jobs that you like, I want to do that in my life? I want to be yelled at every single day of my life for putting tickets on people's windshields. Or any position in retail, those people get beat up. Or a gas station attendant. I worked my junior year of high school in the local gas station where I grew up. And I had people, I'm like a 16-year-old kid, and people coming and yelling at me at that time, like gas prices were probably like 90 cents or something, I don't know. And they're like, yeah, the gas is so high, why do you make it so high? I'm like, I'm 16 years old, I don't set gas prices. I don't know. Or how about, this is the equivalent in our day of a tax collector back in Jesus' day. How about an IRS agent? What kid grows up in their life thinking, someday I'm going to be a tax collector, because everybody loves those people, right? No. What would it feel like every day of your life to be yelled at or hated for doing your job? Some of you who are teachers are going, yeah, okay, that's every day for me, thank you. Guys, this was Levi's life. This was Matthew's life, every single day. When Jesus called Matthew to follow him, it was, someone has said, perhaps the first time for ages that someone had treated him as a human being instead of a piece of dirt. You can tell Matthew is just done with his job, that he's miserable in his life, because Jesus comes to him and says, Levi, follow me. And what does he do? Well, I don't know. I've got this really awesome shack right here that I sit at every day. People hate me and they yell at me. I mean, I am pretty rich, but no, I'm gone. He gets up and he says he follows him immediately. But in typical fashion, Jesus calling Matthew, and especially Jesus celebrating with other tax collectors and sinners, enraged the religious elite. They asked Jesus' disciples, how in the world could Jesus knowingly associate with such scum? they're really what they are, tax collectors. They're not tax collectors, they're tribute collectors. They would collect taxes for the Roman Empire, for the emperor himself. In Matthew's gospel, they actually take it, the religious leaders take it a step further, and they coin a title for Jesus, that Jesus was a friend of sinners. One commentator says they thought to coin a term of criticism, but they added a crown of glory to Jesus. In eternity, the friend of sinners will surround his table with saved sinners who have become his guests. Guys, no nickname could have been more mocking or demeaning or critical of Jesus. And as people who define themselves by their holiness and in terms of separation from sinners, the Pharisees considered anyone who befriended sinful people to be an enemy of God. But what the Pharisees regarded as scandalous was God's grace compassionately pursuing the sinful and the broken. And it's at this point, guys, that I read Matthew's story, and I just think to myself, I'm just sitting there in that moment as he calls Matthew a guy that everybody else hates. My guys, like, you don't understand hate until you understand the hate towards a tax collector. It's at this point that I look at his story and I think we all have to realize what's really being communicated. And it's this, that Jesus sees in us what no one else can. And he turns us into what we're intended to really be. Isn't that fascinating? Isn't that such a lovely picture of Jesus? That he looks at every single one of us. And whereas people may hate you, people may think ill of you, people may say horrible things about you, Jesus says, I see you for who you can be. So let's get you there. That's what he says to Matthew in this moment. Which brings us very quickly to a final moment here, Mark 3:1-6. Jesus went into the synagogue again, and notice a man with a deformed hand. And since it was a Sabbath, Jesus' enemies watched him closely. If he healed the man's hand, they planned to accuse him of working on the Sabbath. Jesus said to the man with a deformed hand, come and stand in front of everyone. Like, Jesus is just picking a fight here, by the way, boys and girls. Then he turned to his critics and asked, does the law permit good deeds on the Sabbath, or is it a day for doing evil? Is it a day to save a life, or is it a day to destroy it? But they would not answer him. And he looked at them angrily, and he was deeply saddened by their hard hearts. And then he said to the man, hold out your hand. And so the man held out his hand, and it was restored. At once the Pharisees went away and met with the supporters of Herod to plot how to kill Jesus. So many instances, Peter's mother-in-law, the man with leprosy, the man now with his withered hand, it says that Jesus simply just says, be healed, and they're fully restored in the moment. There's no waiting. There's no recovery period. They're healed in that moment. And then we have these Pharisees who sit there and just nitpick every single thing. Now, Jesus, wait a minute. Surely you're not doing this on the Lord's day, are you? You're not going to do this on the Sabbath, are you? But please do so we can really nail you to the wall. They're so concerned about their petty little traditions. Guys, God is far more concerned with meeting the needs of people than protecting religious tradition. He makes that abundantly clear throughout the Gospels. He makes it clear throughout all of the Bible, in fact. If you want to go look later, Isaiah 1:11-17, read that and tell me that God doesn't care about people. And here's what I really understand as I read this story of Jesus in the synagogue with this man and this deformed hand. It's a pretty easy thing. It's not rocket science. It's not going to shatter your minds to hear this. But guys, it's always right to do good. There's never a moment where it's like, yeah, like there's a better time for that. Come back tomorrow. Jesus could have done that. This wasn't life-threatening. He could have said, just come back tomorrow. I'll take care of that hand. He says, no, we're going to do this right now. There's never a bad time to do good. It's never out of style to do good and to do the right thing. And if we said last week that the first root, what we called of being and growing as a disciple, first root in a disciple's life is identity, knowing who you are, knowing whose you are, I would say that if we look at all of this today and encompass it and bring it down into one little phrase, it's this, that the second root, the second mark, the second distinctive of being a disciple is serving others and making outsiders insiders. Again, William Barclay says it this way, whenever men forget the love and the forgiveness and the service and the mercy that are at the heart of religion and they replace them by the performance of rules and regulations, religion is in a decline. Christianity has at all times consisted far more in doing the right things than in refraining from doing the wrong things. And that is exactly what irritates so many people today. Not only in the church, but outside the church. It's what irritated the religious leaders of Jesus' day, that Jesus cared very little for rules and regulations, and he cared for people. There was a man by the name of George Whitefield who was an extremely and amazingly popular preacher back in the 18th century. And he was asked one time, George, how do you know that you have preached a really good sermon? And he simply said, that's easy. Either someone gets saved or someone gets angry. Guys, that's a pretty apt description, and it sums up what happens when Jesus shows up here in Mark chapter 2 and Mark chapter 3. And whether it was shrieking demons, whether it was a woman with a fever, whatever diseases people happen to suffer from, Jesus dealt with them, all with the same gentle but deeply effective authority. Jesus came to save sinners, not to call the religious. He came to bring gladness, not sadness. He came to introduce the new, not patch up the old. And he did it all with the power of a simple touch and the power of his word. In 1963, Bill Gaither penned the now famous song, He Touched Me. And whether Bill meant it or not, it stands as a great summary and homage to this section of Mark's Gospels. And I just want to read the chorus. And hear it again as if you're hearing it for the very first time, these words, He touched me. Oh, he touched me. And oh, the joy that floods my soul. Something happened, and now I know. He touched me and made me whole. Will you pray with me? Lord, I pray for every person in this room this morning, every person that's listening online, every person that will hear this later and hear your words later, would understand that your powerful touch, not just to heal, but to restore, to completely and drastically and utterly change our lives, is as real today as it was over 2,000 years ago. And that there would not be a day that goes by in our life that we would not reflect and think about our lives and know that, Lord, you have absolutely had your fingerprints all over our life. And that we would say with the same words that Bill Gaither said many years ago, that you have touched us and you have made us so incredibly whole. For that, Lord, we express our gratitude and our thanksgiving. To you be the glory in all things. Amen.